Morning.
Good morning. The first issue is whether this court has jurisdiction under Hill v. Henderson because the district court did not certify that there was no just reason for delay under Rule 54B. It's our position that this court has jurisdiction over this case. This case is more appropriately analyzed under Ruber v. United States, 773 Fed 2nd, 1367, which was cited in the Hill decision. And that decision held that dismissal of an entire case against a defendant and transfer of the remainder of the case against the other defendants was immediately appealable. And our position is Judge Leon granted summary judgment or dismissed the title.
Was that case under 1631 or 1404?
I'm sorry, was it under
1631 or 1404? I'm not familiar with.
Your Honor, I'd have to take a quick look at the case. I think I have it with me.
Thank you.
But Judge Leon granted summary judgment or dismissed the Title VII claim, and that claim should be appropriate for this court to review.
It sounded to me like the way you described that other case, that was a dismissal of parties. No?
It was dismissal of one party and transfer of remaining parties.
But this is a dismissal of a claim.
It is a dismissal of a claim, Your Honor, but for purposes of review, there's nothing else that needs to be done in terms of providing Dr. Murthy any opportunity to have this claim reviewed. And we would submit that the district court indicated that its decision was a final judgment, and there would be other issues if the court were to decide that it did not have jurisdiction, particularly Dr. Murthy would have to litigate his claims before the Court of Federal Claims, and then if he wanted to appeal the dismissal of his Title VII claim, he would have to attempt to appeal his dismissal before the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. And there's going to be an issue there whether that court has jurisdiction to review Judge Leon's decision. And also, as we indicated in our brief, there's going to be an issue, allowing the case to be heard in this court and exercising jurisdiction over that claim would conserve judicial resources. The issue is here, it could be heard now. If not, Dr. Murthy may be required to wait until the litigation proceeds in the Court of Federal Claims and then perhaps U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. And if that court hears this Title VII claim, it would then have to be sent back to this court because the Court of Federal Claims would not have jurisdiction to review this Title VII claim. So our position is that the court does have jurisdiction. The second issue is the district court's dismissal of the Title VII claim as premature for failure to exhaust administrative remedies. Our position is that the district court erred because the claim was not premature. Dr. Murthy was issued a decision by the Office of Federal Operations in September 2006. He had 90 days or essentially issued a right to sue notice. He had 90 days to file a complaint in court. When he filed his complaint in court, he included claims that were already existing before the agency. But even if the complaint was premature, Dr. Murthy filed an amended complaint in 2007 beyond the 180 days. So that would have corrected any issue with the complaint being premature.
What's your answer to the government's argument that the statute says civil action?
Your Honor, I don't think that there's a distinction between a civil action and filing an amended complaint.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Why isn't your theory barred by our decision in Martini versus Fannie Mae?
Why are we period barred?
Why isn't your claim barred by our decision in Martini, where we said that that the 180-day period was a waiting period that you could not file prematurely?
Well, Your Honor, our position is that we don't believe that it's barred, but even if it is barred, then the court in Martini held And each court that's addressed this issue has held that the appropriate remedy is dismissal without prejudice. And under the court's, the Supreme Court's decision in Zipes, I think it's Zipes v. TWA, the court has made it clear that exhaustion is not a jurisdictional issue, but it's subject to waiver, estoppel, and equitable tolling.
Well, why do you care about this issue, given the government's concession in its brief that this will not be that the order here does not function as a res judicata? I mean, it says it in its brief. It says at page 23, the government says that if you refile the complaint after exhausting your administrative remedies, he, quote, would not face res judicata from the district court decision.
Well, Your Honor,
is that enough to protect you?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. The first issue in the government's
opinion.
I'm sorry.
Suppose we put that in our opinion. Aren't you fully protected?
Well, Your Honor, I think the first issue is that what the government is suggesting is that we go back to the EEOC. And this case was dismissed before an administrative judge at the EEOC in August 2008. They're suggesting we go back to the EEOC, request first allow the complaint to remain there for another 180 days, and then request that the EEOC reinstate this dismissal, and then allow the complaint to remain there 180 days, and then file in court if necessary. We don't believe that it's appropriate for Dr. Murthy to have to go through all of these steps when the court's decision and every court that's considered this issue has concluded that if a complaint is premature, then the appropriate remedy is dismissal without prejudice. Even the decision cited, even in Judge Leon's opinion, he cited a case from the Fourth Circuit where Fourth Circuit said that if there's dismissal, it needs to be without prejudice. And that case was dismissed without prejudice. So Dr. Murthy has been harmed by the district court's decision of dismissing the case with prejudice when it should have been dismissed without prejudice. And once again, I mentioned previously that exhaustion is not a jurisdictional issue, and it's subject to estoppel. And the government argued before the EEOC, when this claim was pending before the EEOC, that Dr. Murthy cannot go forward in this form because this claim is pending in the U.S. District Court. At the same time, in the U.S. District Court, the government was arguing, and they make the argument that Dr. Murthy has not exhausted his administrative remedies because his claim was not pending before the EEOC or pending before the agency for 180 days. So the government can't have it both ways. They can't argue at the EEOC, this claim is in the federal district court, and argue at the same time at the U.S. District Court that you haven't exhausted your administrative remedies by allowing the complaint to remain at the agency for 180 days. Just wanted to cite some of the language from the Zipes decision. Exhaustion Zipes decision is Zipes v. TWA, 455 U.S. 385, 1982 case. Exhaustion of administrative remedies is, as the Supreme Court has stated, a requirement that, unlike a statute of limitations, is subject to waiver, estoppel, and equitable tolling. In this court, in Lou v. Heckler, 768 Fed Second 409, 1985, stated that the exhaustion requirement is not intended to be construed to place a heavy technical burden, particularly on employees who proceeded pro se and thus were untrained in negotiating procedural laboriness. So our position, Your Honor, is that dismissal by the district court was dismissal without prejudice was inappropriate. This court should exercise jurisdiction over this appeal.
All right. Why don't we hear from the government, and then you can respond.
Good May it please the court. Good morning. Alan Birch on behalf of the government. With me at council table is Craig Lawrence from our office, as well as Brian Sunfield from the agency. There are two issues today, the appellate jurisdiction and the merits of the exhaustion. I'd like to talk about the jurisdictional issue first. The court issued an order asking the parties to address the application of Hill versus Henderson and the general rule of a final order below. And the district court's order certainly was not final, so for the court to exercise jurisdiction, you would need to be in an exception to the final judgment rule. And Hill versus Henderson suggests that when there's a dismissal against the parties, for example, all of a particular plaintiff, that it is final with respect to those plaintiffs and the appeal can be heard with respect to those plaintiffs. It's analogous to a Rule 54B partial entry of judgment. The court's decisions since then have, a couple of unpublished opinions, have extended that to cases where particular defendants were also dismissed in their entirety. And again, in both of those cases, whether it's the plaintiffs or the defendants, the interests of finality can be met in a way that is relatively easy to cabin, in that the concerns of creating inconsistent judgments down the road with respect to the remaining claims is minimal. That situation, I think, applies here, too, because of the subject matter distinction between the Title VII claims and the contract claims. The contract claims here are very separable from the Title VII claims, and so if you were to reach an appellate decision on the Title VII claim at issue here, there would be very little risk of overlapping or contradictory factual legal issues with respect to any appeal that might issue from the Federal Circuit. That's one of the key distinctions between this case, this situation, and situations involving transfers for venue.
Transfers for what?
For venue. That's what most of the case law talks about, and there.
Does your office have any idea of how often this type of situation arises, or is likely to arise?
From our experience, it's certainly the exception. It's unusual. We don't see very many of these cases coming through. It does appear in another subject matter area, and that is the Equal Pay Act claims, which need to go to the Court of Federal Claims also. The case law on that is perhaps even thinner than it is on Tucker Act transfers, so there's not a lot there.
It's just a fact of the Court of Claims and the Federal Circuit jurisdiction that's
right.
Created this.
Exactly. I would point the court's attention to the Weber case, mm-hmm. In which involved an Equal Pay Act claim that was transferred.
Do you know the County of Cook case, United States versus County of Cook? I don't believe it.
I'm not familiar with that.
It's a Federal Circuit case, which seems to me to be quite on point here. And the Federal Circuit says that in a 1631 case, that under the statutory site is 28 U.S.C. 1292 D4A,
right.
An amendment to the statute seems to anticipate this very.
Right, that statute gives the Federal Circuit the exclusive power to review the transfer decision, whether it's in whole or in part.
In whole or in part,
right.
Yeah.
So the decision, but that's consistent with this court's right. Prior order anyway. The transfer decision is not before this court. The court's prior order in this case said exactly that this court lacks jurisdiction because of the statute. So anything that the district court actually did transfer to the Court of Federal Claims is not mm-hmm. in front of this court now.
It suggests it's fine for the district court to retain jurisdiction over the non-selection claim here, right?
Right, right. And I do think Mr. Branch is correct that if you waited for the proceedings to play out in the Court of Federal Claims, that there would be a very difficult jurisdictional issue facing the Federal Circuit in how to resolve the Title VII claim at that point. And so for that reason,
as I read that statute, I mean, it's the functional equivalent of a severance, right? I mean, it operates as a severance, so that we now have two, in effect, two proceedings here, right?
That's right, Your Honor. That would be our understanding as well.
In fact, I believe that's how the Federal Circuit is supposed to treat it, as if it was first filed and before them.
That may be so. Yeah. That said, I'm at a little bit of a loss to suggest how bright line of a rule to suggest to the court on that, because there is the possibility, of course, that some other case could present more of a risk of entanglement between the transferred claims and the retained claims. So it may not make sense to make a bright line rule based simply on the Tucker Act versus Title VII, but certainly that should be, at a minimum, I would think, a very important factor going to the risk of undermining the finality rule. If there are no other questions on the jurisdiction, I'll move on to the dismissal, or the summary judgment, I should say, for the remaining claim, which was Mr. Murphy's non-selection claim for the associate deputy administrator position. The key dispute here seems to be whether the remedy as to whether the court should have entered a judgment without prejudice. Keep in mind this was summary judgment because there's no dispute that that was proper. The court properly went beyond the pleadings to resolve the matter, and so what Mr. Murthy is asking for is a summary judgment without prejudice, which strikes me as a little unusual, but I think the most important point to be made is that with or without prejudice is essentially immaterial. What needs to happen is development of some further factual.
So the government doesn't object to a remand with directions to dismiss without prejudice, though?
Well, I think that would run afoul of the harmless error rule because it doesn't affect substantive rights of the parties. There's no need to disturb the finding below because Mr. Murthy's rights, substantive rights, are the same either way. He needs to go back and at least attempt to reopen the administrative process.
You can understand his, I'll say, discomfort with relying on something the government wrote in a brief. And that's why he's seeking, it seems to me, what Judge Tatel was suggesting, a statement by the court.
The statement by the court is one thing, remand instructions to change the...
Isn't that what we did in Martini?
In Martini, what you specifically did mm-hmm. was you ordered the... You essentially had language that said instructions to dismiss her complaint without prejudice. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind that the with or without prejudice was not disputed or argued in that case. Mm-hmm. But then the court went on to say because the EEOC has stopped processing her charge 21 days after she filed it, Martini may file a new complaint in district court only after the commission has attempted to resolve her charge for an additional 159 days. Government would not have an objection to similar language here, but it's unnecessary to reach the holding, the judgment below, in order to effectuate that.
What about the response to your statutory argument about the 180 days?
Could you be a little more specific? I'm not sure.
I'm sorry. I'm not hearing you.
I'm sorry. Could you be more specific? Which statutory?
Well, Judge Tatel asked counsel for appellant about the government's position that you could not substitute an amended complaint to overcome the premature filing of the original complaint.
Well, I think there is a distinction to be made between a civil action and a complaint. The rules distinguish between the two below. He didn't file a motion for leave to file an amended complaint. In his motion for reconsideration below, at Joint Appendix 17, he simply asks that the dismissal be converted to without prejudice.
I suppose the point is that nothing's going on at EEOC. So what's the harm? I mean, it's not as though that there's any inclination that, or indication that negotiations are going on or settlement, and he's trying to jump the gun.
So what's the harm in what?
We do have cases where people file prematurely.
Yes.
And then we say, you know, it ripens into a properly filed.
Well, I'm not aware of any decisions on the 180-day rule for that.
Well, how come you don't think Martini controls the case? I'm curious why you didn't argue that.
Well,
I mean, from the, that supports your view. Why doesn't it?
Yeah, I wondered that myself when I was rereading the briefs. Perhaps we should have relied on Martini more in the brief. The
well, I mean, I can see a big difference, but I'm curious what you think it is.
I'm sorry, what?
I said I see some differences, but I'm just curious as to why you didn't argue Martini.
The main problem we have with Martini is the relief that says...
No, I'm not talking about the relief.
The direction with...
I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about... Martini held that the 180-day period was a waiting period. You couldn't file prematurely, right?
Right.
So why doesn't that control this case?
Well, I think it does. I mean,
you didn't argue that in your brief.
Well, I think we get there from the statute and the regulation.
Well, Martini didn't do that.
I think it did. It had a statutory interpretation.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. Why isn't Martini different? Because in Martini, you had the EEOC issued a premature right to sue letter.
Well, it is different because of that. The procedure, I think, has changed since then. I'm not sure that they do that anymore or can do that anymore. The regulation.
Well, they can't because of Martini. Right. I mean, what we said in Martini was, look, if they issue an early right to sue letter, mm-hmm. they're not going to try to resolve the case through mediation.
Right.
And the 180-day period was designed to make sure the agency did that.
Right.
Well, here it didn't do that, so isn't Martini different?
The agency didn't do...
Didn't issue a... did the agency issue a right to sue letter?
No.
No. That's my point. So in other words, the agency could have continued to mediate or do whatever it does during the 180-day period, even though the appellant here filed his lawsuit.
Conceivably, but the agency, I mean, it's a bit presumptuous for the agency to be doing anything when there's a district court case filed. And so that's why the agencies properly stand down or should when district courts
do cases filed. Does it? If someone files a complaint, does the agency... stop its proceedings?
I don't know. I don't believe that they do that as a matter of practice because oftentimes they don't discover it right away. But that's as soon as they do, and then they, you know, bring the ship to a halt.
That was the representation that the government was arguing because it was a case in court. The agency proceedings couldn't proceed. Is that incorrect?
I'm sorry. I didn't catch the beginning.
Are we all having trouble hearing each other today? Is it because the mics aren't in the right spot? I thought the representation was made by counsel for appellant that the government was arguing before the agency that because a complaint had been filed in court, the agency could not proceed.
That's right. That's right. And so that's how it usually comes to the attendee, or that's how it plays out once the agency
and so
becomes
so now the argument the government is making is that, but you filed too early. And he's arguing you can't have it both ways. But
you can't have both proceedings going on at the same time, and the... So that is how that plays out. Now, you know, the statute is clear that you can't go to court early. The regulation is clear that you can't go to court early.
I think you have to speak up, counsel.
That could be the problem.
All right.
Okay. There's nothing inconsistent about pointing out that he can't have both proceedings going on at the same time. He hasn't complied with the statutory waiting period, so proceeding in district court should be dismissed or terminated because of that. And at the same time, agency proceeding needs to stop because we don't know how the court is going to determine whether it will take jurisdiction or not. And so it's up to the, at some level, it has to be up to the employee to know the rules and comply with them. There's nothing unclear about the 180-day waiting period. Either in the regulation or the statute.
All right. Anything further?
No. We would ask that the judgment be affirmed.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant?
Our position, once again, is that Dr. Murthy was placed in a position of having his complaint dismissed before the EEOC because the agency argued that the complaint was in court, And at the same time, the agency was arguing in court that the matter was premature. The complaint that was in court, it ripened at some point. It remained at the agency for 180 days. So any time after 180 days, Dr. Murthy could have filed a new complaint, and in this instance, he filed an amended complaint. And it was improper for the district court to dismiss his amended complaint once his complaint had been present before the agency for more than 180 days, and that's what the district court did. When the district court dismissed his complaint, the district court was aware, and we made the argument, that even if you determine that the initial filing was premature, it has now ripened and it's appropriate before the court. The only question is whether the court was obligated to, or that the plaintiff was obligated to file a new complaint, or whether he could amend his existing complaint in court. We're beyond the 180 days. It certainly would not conserve judicial resources for every plaintiff in this situation to file an entirely new complaint when he already has a complaint pending in court, raising essentially the same issues. Dr. Murthy filed an amended complaint after the 180 days. The district court's dismissal of his amended complaint was inappropriate, was an error, and it should be reversed.
All right. Thank you.
No other questions? Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.